Welcome to The Gathering Resources. The following audio is from our breakout session entitled, How to Fight Fear and Loathing in America. This session is moderated by Josh Good and features David French and Cherie Harder.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for making time. The strategic wisdom of shifting to the shade is evident all around us. This is obviously a very talented group, and we want to make time for conversation and questions, your questions. So what we're going to try to aim to do is do about 20 to 25 minutes of conversation up front, and then a full 20 minutes of things that you're thinking about in light of current events and some of the deeper cultural, political realities that these two speakers, panelists, are going to reflect on with us all together. Normally this is kind of considered to be the current events panel, the sort of latest headlines and latest happenings. And it's been an interesting week, an immigration surge at the border. France pulling out its ambassador. France, this yesterday because of what's happening with the Australian military front. But much more, Biden's approval rating dropping to 44%. I suspect we'll have some thoughts from David about these questions with the sort of overall views of Afghanistan and things he knows firsthand, and really from Cherie as well. But that is our goal, and in talking with Josh Kwan, we thought we'd sort of shift a little bit from immediate headlines to a little bit sort of deeper cultural, political, just sort of sense that something may be a bit amiss as we're all in the water together and navigating things. So we are looking forward to hearing from our panelists a little bit on technology, on isolation and disconnectedness, and some of the changed media habits, but also some of the areas of expertise. And I want to introduce first this morning Cherie Harder, who is president of the Trinity Forum. We heard from David yesterday, Cherie, about a lot of things really ultimately landing on a different kind of politics and the fruit of the Spirit. You've had a half a career in government. You worked with Bill Frist on the Hill. You worked at Empower America. You worked as special assistant to President Bush and as effectively chief of staff to Laura Bush. And then in 2008, you got out and you pivoted to an organization that fosters civil conversations, that tries to put us back in touch with firsthand principles, firsthand classics, ideas, and documents that the Trinity Forum talks about. What's your sense of where we are compared to 2008 when you got out of government? You've talked about this speech President Bush just gave, but also sort of the larger changed reality the last 5+ years. What's your sense of where we are, Cherie?
Is this on? Can you all hear me? Excellent. Well, first of all, thank you, Josh, for the question, and just thanks for the gathering, for inviting me to speak or be on a panel. It's great fun to do this, and great fun to do this with two friends, and Josh and David. I think it's fair to say that a lot has changed since I left the White House in 2008. I think if someone had said back then that we'd be at a place where there was the same degree of conspiracy thinking, where the New York Times would have said that around 15% of Americans in a recent poll said that sometimes violence might be necessary as a last resort to protecting one's values. I think we would have been shocked to incomprehension as well as deeply grieved by the levels of not just division, but what's been called affective polarization, hating the other person, as well as the lack of agreement on such fundamental things as not just what is right or wrong or better or worse, but what is real versus false. I think there have been some big changes that have happened technologically and culturally that has probably helped fuel this. You know, when I left the White House in 2008, Twitter had just been invented 2 years earlier. It wasn't until 2009 that anyone had a big Twitter following. Instagram wasn't invented until 2010. You know, there are currently over 1 billion people who are on Instagram globally. And all that has had a real effect on our political and our public discourse. Barack Obama was the first person to use a presidential tweet that was as late as 2015. In contrast, the previous president tweeted over 11,000 times in his presidential capacity. So that's not only affected, I think, public discourse, but it's also affected how we get our information and how we relate to each other as citizens. And I think that has essentially kind of played out. As incredible as our technologies are and as much good as they have done, it's also played out to essentially reinforce our biases, make it harder to actually speak to each other vulnerably and frankly, and kind of reinforced some of the worst tendencies of conflict in ways that would have seemed almost cartoonish, I think, when I first left office, or first left working for the White House. So those are a quick, depressing dive into some of the changes, I think, that we've seen.
And David, you have said a lot of things yesterday to us about this sort of cultural snapshot as well. And the first sentence of your latest book effectively says that the continued unity of the United States of America can't be guaranteed. Curious to ask what you mean by that, picking up on some of the themes that Sheree just talked about. You write in your newsletters a lot about kind of connecting what's happening in Washington with evangelicals. Mm-hmm. There may be 80 or 85 million evangelicals. It's not the subculture tribe of every one of us in the audience, but it's a lot of us. And so your sort of lane of connecting those two groups is distinct. I hope everybody will sign up for David's Dispatch newsletter, which is really first-rate reading, especially Sunday mornings. But what does that mean, and where are we on that spectrum?
What that means is exactly what it says. I don't think that it is guaranteed that the United States will remain together as a country. I do think it is possible, and we already have seen on the fringes secessionary movements in the United States. And, you know, it's funny, my book came out September 22nd, 2020, and I was really nervous about it because I used the S word, secession. And, you know, a lot of people will say, yeah, we're really divided. Yeah, we really hate each other. I don't see that ending anytime soon. But the instant you say, you move to the next level of saying, well, this means we could split, then people are saying, in 2020, we're saying, whoa, that's a little too far. Now, after the election contest in January 6th, a lot of people are saying, could this actually happen? Because we've seen things we didn't think we would see with our eyes in our lifetime. And the reason why I went to the S word is I went back and I looked at the two previous secessionary movements in the United States, the 1776, where we seceded from the British Empire, and 1861, where the Confederacy seceded from the Union. And I saw some really disturbing parallels, because it's not the case that all disunity or all division creates the potential of a national split. For example, in 1968, we had 2 to 3 domestic terror bombings a day in the U.S. But there was no real idea that there would be some sort of secessionary movement, because there was just a very widespread, geographically diffuse radical fringe that was engaging in, you know, a violent action. And, you know, in 72, Nixon wins 49 states. I mean, there wasn't this sort of geographically distinct division in the U.S. And so what I went back and I looked and I saw, so in 76 and 1861, and in now, you have geographically contiguous, nation-state-sized entities that believe that their very cultural existence as a distinct culture is under attack. This was the situation of the colonists. This is the situation of the slave states in the South, who they centered their identity around their status as slave states. And in 1776 and in 1861, the thing that tipped it over from just disunity and division and turmoil into actual secession was the feeling of an existential threat, was the feeling of physical danger. So you had the British regulars in Boston conducting raids into the countryside in 1861. You had the partisan press in the South. If you read McPherson's Battle Cry of Freedom, the partisan press in the South whipped the Southerners into what it called an unreasoning fury, what McPherson called an unreasoning fury, full of conspiracy theories about the desires of the North to conduct genocidal violence on the South. In fact, if you read the secession documents of the Southern states, which I would recommend to anyone who has any lingering doubt about what secession was about, Texas, for example, contains a conspiracy theory. It contains a conspiracy theory that abolitionists in the North were seeking to poison Texans. And so what I said is we have 3 of the 4 conditions: giant geographically contiguous areas, with distinct cultures that believe the cultures are under attack, but we don't have the fourth, which is we feel a sense of physical threat and danger from our political opponents, and that is changing. The riots in 2020, the Capitol storming in 2021, and so we are now in a more dangerous place than we were. And there's no really big force in American life that is saying, no, stop this. Because quite frankly, that's not where the money is. The money is in, these people are horrible. These people are horrible. And I've got the answer to that. And the answer is their total defeat and destruction, which is exactly the wrong message.
Thank you, David. So, Sheree, in your work, both in government and now with political leaders, elites, with business leaders, the people involved in culture making of various kinds, you interact with folks who are reading a lot of these trends and yet have somehow, sometimes, maintained a different set of habits, different rituals, different liturgies, a different kind of calm gait alongside the reality that David's talking about. Would you be willing to reflect on, you know, the last 5 or 10 years, some sort of meta-level observations about people that you find to be healthy and constructive and fruitful?
Oh, wow. I mean, it's a beautiful question, Josh. And the answer would probably make for a good 30-minute talk. But, you know, a couple of things. One, just as we were sort of alluding to earlier, I think it's fair to say that people who are steady, wise, are, with rare exceptions, the very online. You know, they're not folks who have immersed themselves into, you know, responding to everything on social media, spending hours a day with talk radio or with television. Our technologies, not just the content itself, but our technologies are never neutral. Certain technologies bias towards different forms of content, just like you can't do philosophy by smoke signal. You know, the form itself kind of precludes the content. And certain, you know, they bias us certain ways. Someone said, I forget who it was, but if you're trying to come up with a medium better aimed or better honed to destroy democracy, it'd be really hard to do anything better than Twitter. Yeah. You know, in that essentially what it rewards is speed, snark, the extreme take, attention getting. And of course, the way you get attention is usually by being quick, witty, extreme, kind of outrageous. When we kind of immerse our time and our attention in technologies that bias us towards ways of interacting with others that are without reflection, forbearance, or grace, eventually it does something to our outlooks, our assumptions, our decisions, and our character. And so one of the things we try to do at the Trinity Forum is we do quarterly readings where we take the best of literature and letters, you know, provide an introduction saying why it's important, and give people essentially a chance to kind of do a deep dive into a worthy story or essay that is actually raises the big questions of life and stands the test of time. A second thing I would say is rarely do they look to politics for meaning or for identity. And I think one of the challenges that we have faced as a country, and perhaps also as a church, is that we are grounding more of our identity in the political rather than in who we are as utterly beloved children of God. And of course, our identity as utterly beloved children of God never changes, and it's never rocked. But what has happened kind of on a grand national scale is that our identities have become increasingly political as our politics has grown increasingly toxic and apocalyptic. And I think that has been a destabilizer, not just of individual lives, people that we probably all know and we think, like, what happened to them, you know, over the last 5 years, but also on a much broader level as well. And the third thing I would simply say are the commitments and priorities. You know, Augustine talked about virtue being the order amorum, the proper ordering of one's priorities. And I think that's kind of an essential trait for the long haul in leadership.
Wonderful, thank you. And maybe one for David that gets us back to sort of big picture worry. Sorry, but
I specialize in big picture worry.
I mean, somehow you seem to always land on the fact in your letters that, right, like, God's still on his throne, and
yep.
it's going to be okay. But still,
God's
you got the
still
details
on his throne,
I'm
and it's going to be okay.
Yeah. All right, so you earned a Bronze Star in Iraq, and you followed what happened in Afghanistan more closely than some of the rest of us. I'm curious to get your response to this wonderful quote about 10 days ago from a NATO European general who was sort of reflecting on his sense of where the United States is in terms of engagement in the world, but also in terms of values here at home. And here's the quote, okay? So he said, quote, "Most countries around the world are now agreeing with China that the democracies might be at the end of our history. Because democracies depend on shared values, and there aren't many shared values. And it's obvious that in your country, in the United States, you're not willing to fight for your values. There's just not enough depth to anything shared, and Afghanistan proves it. We've invested a lot in the fight against the Taliban for 20 years, but now we're going to go back to a world with a stronger Taliban, despite the fact that they haven't changed in any way whatsoever. We democracies are simply not willing to fight against the Taliban or to really fight for anything." And then he goes on to say that China is rising, and what do you think is coming down? So the question, I guess, is, you know, what's your view on whether the rising generation has the will and the conviction to defend and advance the American values of liberal democracy and pluralism?
Well, number one, the rising generation has the will and conviction to defend the pluralism and liberal democracy. And one of the ways we know this is the rising generation has enlisted year after year after year and voluntarily served, often double and triple volunteers. So you volunteer to join the military, then you volunteer for combat arms, for example, and then you often volunteer again to go overseas. So we have not had ever a shortage of people willing to do that. So that when the rubber meets the road, the American civilization has generated more than enough young people who are willing to put everything aside and go. Now, that does not mean that they have been well led. There is a difference. And there was this phrase in World War I that I think is unfair to the generals of World War I, but they described the fighting men of France and Britain as lions led by donkeys. And that is it's a little unfair because everyone had trouble figuring out how to deal with the machine gun, for example, but that's a different rabbit hole. But do we have the strength? I think yes. I don't think our culture is done. I don't think our culture is done at all. In fact, there's an awful lot of social science that indicates that there is a critical mass of Americans on the left and on the right who are fed up with this. They're fed up with this. They're called in the social science research by Moore and Common the exhausted majority. And what's happening in our country is that as increasing amount, as political discourse gets increasingly toxic, people are not fighting it, they're withdrawing from it. And so I'll give you a perfect example. I was talking to a doctor in Franklin, where I live, Franklin, Tennessee, go Vols, wearing this not for Vols propaganda, but because my bald head will burn in the sun. So I was talking to him, and he said, you know, after January, and he's a staunch Republican, just a great guy, but, you know, not a guy who defines himself by his politics. And he said, after January 6th, I just turned it all off. I stopped watching Fox. I deleted social media from my apps, and my blood pressure is down. I'm happier. And I thought, good for you, bad for us. Good for you because, yeah, you're living a life that is disconnected. Now that you're disconnected from all this toxicity, your life is better. Bad for us because you've disconnected from all this toxicity and you're a good guy. We need the good guys to stand up to the toxicity. And so I think what we have is we have a latent constituency of people who are ready for something else. They're ready for something else. But what makes it tricky is it's not specifically ideological. It's people on the left. It's people on the right. It's people in the middle. Where's their institution? Who's their voice? And that's what makes this difficult. But are they there? Absolutely. I mean, you should read my inbox. You should read my inbox of people from the left to the right saying, you know, where is the sanity? Where is the grace? Where is the compassion? And they feel safe emailing me, but they don't feel safe saying that on even to their friends on Facebook. And so I think that we have an enormous amount of hope because there is an enormous constituency that sees this problem, but right now it lacks direction, it lacks institutions, it lacks leadership. And one last thing, just to give us some more hope here, because I've often talked about grim things. We're not where we were at the end of 1979, or at the end of 1980, beginning of 1981, where America seemed to be in retreat economically, militarily. The Soviet Union seemed to be completely ascendant. We had been through 12 years of division and strife and Watergate and fall of Saigon and gas lines. And there was a lot of smart people who said that we were done. I remember reading the books. I was old enough and nerdy enough as a young teenager to read books about American decline. I still remember them. 12 years later, we were the world hyperpower. The Soviet Union didn't exist anymore. The American economy had roared back. There was an unprecedented level in recent past of American unity and optimism. So to sit there and say, now we're done. Well, we could be, but there is a strong, million strong group of people who are silently saying no. They just need to vocally say no.
That's lovely. And you just heard David say that if you get bored this afternoon during the free time, you can read his inbox. As much chatter as... So let's flip to you. We've got more questions we can draw upon if we need to, but we've got an outstanding room. Who's first? Kurt Barron's Iskar Trust.
I want to... David, my question... There were actually two, but I'll ask a second on what you just talked. The guy who disconnected, is the only option to reconnect with social media? Because it seems to be part of the challenge, and this isn't to diminish the work, because there is need for information. But increasingly, studies show information doesn't change minds. So can we be imaginative of how might we help connect people who are on this discontented, exhausted?
Yeah.
I mean, part of it, I think, is the real exhaustion. So what could we give them to do or other ways to connect than putting them back into the toxic world of social media?
That's a great... The question was, for those in the back who probably couldn't hear, was... If this doctor who disconnected, can he reconnect, but does he have to reconnect through social media? Which is a fantastic question. I do think some people need to reconnect through social media because to abandon these immense forms of communication entirely to the most toxic elements will be and is devastating to our culture. That's the only reason I continue to subject myself to Twitter is I feel like I gotta still talk. But I would say this, you can disconnect technologically, you can reconnect socially and institutionally. So what did I say earlier? Is there what institution is there that is voicing that is advocating for these beliefs and values?
And this is the problem. The church has participated in the division
right.
rather than offered the alternative.
Right. And he just said the church has participated in the division rather than offer the alternative. So reconnect individually and institutionally and reconnect locally, okay? Because if there's one thing that we have seen that's been very devastating is the toxicity of national debate is now leaking all the way down to local politics. All politics is now national. My own county, Williamson County, Tennessee, I bet there's some Franklinites in the House, yes. You know we trended nationally because... Masks, and we had people, including someone who writes a worship newsletter, physically threaten the lives of doctors and nurses who are advocating masking in schools. And we made national news. So here's a way to reconnect. Reconnect so if you're going to be trending nationally from your local news is because you are engaging intelligently and with compassion. So connect institutionally, connect locally. And you know your heart and soul better than anybody else, if you can handle it without it destroying you, reconnect technologically.
Right here, sir. Let's aim for sort of rapid fire. More questions rather than not. So quick answers. Thank you very much, Peter Greer.
Does the press? I don't think you're going to like this question.
Next question.
Does the press realize how much they have contributed to the current state of affairs? There's this movement among the press towards being proud of advocacy and agenda journalism as opposed to objective journalism. And so literally people like myself, and I'm talking the right and the left press, not just one, that you don't know what you can trust anymore, what you're getting. And so, you know, and there's this kind of arrogance that, you know, if we choose certain stories and other stories, they'll never figure out that we're biasing things or we edit a certain way. I think the audience is very savvy to what's going on in terms of editing. And there's this sense in which you don't know who you can trust. You just and then you've got the social media that will cancel you if you say anything that's not quite PC. And I mean, it used to be that you could say a lot of things. I know people have just been taken off for just presenting a point of view, not using swear words or other things, and or even just deciding that they didn't want to stay on a certain platform. All of a sudden, all their posts were canceled. You know, I mean, so this is a major problem.
I work with journalists a bunch in my day job, so let me take that real quick. I just think, you know, obviously we've all watched the politicization of everything. We've watched the institution of journalism generally be more like a platform than a form that shapes you and molds you, like our friend Yuval Levin talks about in his wonderful book on institutions. You know, local journalism imploding. A lot of times when you answer that Gallup question about whether you trust the media or trust journalism, there's a sort of broad national mob in mind, not your local. And if you talk about your local journalists in Cincinnati or in San Diego, well, that guy's all right. But it's this sort of, and it's not an easy fix, right? I do think there are a lot of journalists who are a little better than we tend to think, who are in the game. And one observation I've encountered is that it's not the case that most journalists work alone. I always thought that was the nerd reporter who goes out and does a story and discovers something interesting about the school board by herself, like an individual playing golf. It's more commonly the case that a lot of journalists talk. They work with their editor. They work with their friends. David has his group of friends. Cherie's got a community. And that shapes the story. And so it's sort of, you know, the work of getting into those ecosystems and the like. Fred Smith. Sorry.
Oh, can I say one thing real fast? The audience is not savvy. The audience is not savvy. And the reason why a lot of our media atmosphere, media is built the way it is it relentlessly exploits that fact. Right-wing media in particular is relentlessly exploiting its audience gullibility. And it's stunning to see. There were deficiencies in mainstream media, and so the right-wing community decided to build a competing media enterprise that is, if possible, more cynical and worse. And it makes a giant amount of money doing it. So I dispute that the audience is savvy. The audience is often being led around by the nose.
Is that, for example, Ben Shapiro?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, Fox Primetime. Fox Primetime is an example of exploiting the audience. Breitbart.com, which is the second largest audience online on conservative in the right wing, is an example of exploiting the audience. I could just go on and on and on. There's very little original reporting that's done in right wing media, very little. It's almost all takes. The fact that, for example, a person like Alex Berenson can be continually and still on Fox News is an example of the audience is not savvy. The audience is being exploited. And one of the reasons why we formed the Dispatch is rather than curse the darkness, we wanted to light a candle. And that's what people have to do. We have to build competing institutions because the institutions that we right now have in large degree are rotten.
That's what I want to follow up on is that specifically. And I just think, you know, Hannah Arendt said that eventually the population would know that both, they're all lying, and it's just a matter of who has the most clever lies. But on this institution, if you could say what institutions need to be supported, what institutions need to be created for this, you know, latent constituency of people looking for something else, because without those institutions, then we're all just at sea. So short list, institutions that need to be supported, institutions that need to be created.
Want to take that, Sheree?
Do something. Why don't you go? No.
Okay, institutions that need to be created. We need to resurrect local news. That's very, very important. The fact of the matter is that all news is national news, and all local disputes become national disputes. What we need to do is resurrect local news, resurrect the ability, the notion that a person should be able to be engaged in the place where they have the most influence. Here's a general rule of thumb. You have, as a human being, you have very little influence over a very large number of people, and you have a lot of influence over a very small number of people. And what we see increasingly in our country right now is we're focusing our attention and our frustration on the areas in where we have really no influence. And we are retreating from those spheres of life where we have maximum influence. And this is extraordinarily toxic, extraordinarily. And so it leads to endless frustration because you have no ability to change the thing that makes you the angriest. And you're totally neglecting the area where you have the most ability to change the things that actually affect your life. And how upside down is that? So local institutions, I think, is so important.
You know, I'll just add on to that. In addition to the local papers, which I totally second, local institutions in general, I think, are hugely important in that is where there is the most influence. And not just influence, but relational formation in the lives of people. And so much, this is kind of a broad sweeping statement rather than a laundry list of institutions, but I think, and you all know, so much of charitable appeals are on the base of fear, loathing, or urgency. You know, as opposed to the flourishing of one's neighbor in the fullness of time. Like, that raises no money. And I think that kind of switch is actually something rather important. The long haul, the deep relational investment, the people who do not deliberately stoke, there are times where there are things that are urgent. But fear and loathing rarely leads to a place of grace or flourishing or shalom. And I think it's a countercultural move to seek out the organizations and institutions that are actually kind of working for more reflection, more grace, more forbearance, like thicker relational bonds, deeper thinking, and to seek out those because they're never going to be the ones who get the headlines, they're rarely going to be sexiest, and they're not going to be like on the tip of everyone's tongue.
I think we've got one from Bill Wichterman, and I want to just quickly say, if we're spending more time on screens, if, as Tim Keller says, 12 to 15 hours a day are spent watching Fox News or watching MSNBC in your apartment by yourself, a divorced 60-year-old male, it's not good for the flourishing. So, we can agree on that.
Are you sure about that?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
So institutions that involve kindling face-to-face, rekindling that, including the church. Bill.
So related comment for asking your reaction to is the relationship between both demonization and epistemological crisis across the country. So on the demonization, we hate one another and we think the worst of one another, and there have been studies which have actually indicated that the more education you have, the less you understand your political opposition's actual views, which is counterintuitive. You think it's those rubes living, in your town, David, where that's the case. No. The more educated you are, the less you understand what the Democrats think or the Republicans think, whatever you're not, number one. And then, so that's on the demonization side. And then on the epistemological side, I thought that, I'm a conservative, I thought it was the left that had an epistemological crisis. I realize it seems to be a national crisis because the right seems uninterested in truth very often. And when you come to somebody who's like, they've got their meme, they're working this out, and you tell them a contrary fact, they're not really happy to hear that. Yeah. They're annoyed that you've said that.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that. Okay, so this is so important to understand, okay? Here's why you cannot fact check someone out of falsehood, okay? There's a lot of heart level work that has to be done before the fact check will work. And there's actually some physiological studies that have been done about this, that if you are a committed partisan and you receive information about a fact that contradicts your belief system, it activates the fight or flight nodes. So you literally react involuntarily, emotionally, as if you have been attacked. And so that's one reason why people get actually angry when they receive a fact check, for example, and they'll desperately try to find a way that it's not true. And so what happens is once you've crossed that threshold into the partisan identity, then it is incredibly difficult to quote-unquote fact check or reason or argue. And what Bill said is very interesting. It's not just that more educated people are more wrong about their political opponents. It's even worse than that. The more time you spend on political media, the more wrong you are about your opponents. So it's the people who are consuming the most media who are the most wrong. And so the people who almost watch no media at all are the most correct about why are their, what their political opponents believe. Why? Because they get their data about their opponents through these really outdated things called friendships. And so one of the things that I think is absolutely key for us as a church, and I'm not saying don't vote Republican or don't vote Democrat or don't vote at all, but we have to shed the partisan identity. Because the partisan identity, it defines us and it even inhibits our ability to see truth. And it's often so deeply ingrained that it's involuntary. You know, if somebody tries to fact check me about something, like for example, I have a deeply ingrained Southeastern Conference football partisan identity. And if you try to send me a fact check that says the Big Ten is better, my first instinct is I want to fight. Not to reason through it. I mean, I'm only partially sold out to the SEC. But but when something becomes a matter of identity, it's removed from here. It's removed from here. And that's something that's so key for us to understand. And so you have people that you're frustrated with in your lives, and you send them this article, you send them that article. People have started to email me, and they say, what do I do about my aunt who believes this awful, crazy thing? And the first thing I ask them, and I've started to respond by saying, how much time do you spend with your aunt? That's the question. It is not, here's the resource you need. It is, how much time do you spend? And that does the heart prep that opens up the mind.
Yeah, just to pile on for a second there, with it, partisan identity sort of ideas that David was talking about, one of the things that has been kind of really distressing to see is the ways that our partisan identities have actually subsumed so many of our other identities. It used to be that the most important thing for the majority of American parents when they met the person that their child was going to marry was, do they share the same faith? Now it is, are they from the same party? And there have been many indications that actually even the ways we identify in terms of our faith commitments are the things that are shaped by our partisan affiliations as opposed to vice versa. Faith used to be the unmoved mover of identity. Now it is more in flux too. There are people who are, we were talking just a little bit earlier about an article out showing that greater numbers of people who don't actually go to church are calling themselves evangelicals because of how they voted, as opposed to anything creedal. So the term has largely become a tribal rather than a creedal term. And one second. And I think that also kind of helps explain, you know, a really unfortunate phenomenon. You would think that, you know, Bible-grounded Christians would be the least likely people to be taken in by conspiracies. You know, and yet, that's not the case. Self-reported evangelicals have been the most likely, you know, to weigh in or to affirm at least parts of the Q conspiracy theory, you know, as well as a whole other variety of, you know, vaccine hesitancy and skepticism. So that, you know, we have not been immune from this. And I think some of this is, it's a matter not just of mistaken partisan identification, but also of spiritual formation going on.
I've got data. Two-thirds of Republican Christians who go to church once a year or less now identify as evangelical. The number of self-identified evangelicals who don't go to church at all has quadrupled, or the percentage has quadrupled in the last decade. And so what you're talking about is a, and now these are self-identified, not people who all assent to the four parts of the Bebbington Quadrilateral, okay? This is self-identified. And so what's happened is an enormous number of people who are sort of nominally Christian and Republican, that means I'm evangelical. And so the data is really just staggering.
And one last point is one would think that certainty and confusion wouldn't positively track. But that's actually exactly what we're finding, that often the people who are the most certain about their views are the most likely to be confused about what has actually happened. And, you know, often, especially within the evangelical community, we tend to valorize certainty. And I think about what Dallas Willard said, that really certainty tells you much more about the psychological state of mind of someone rather than the reliability of the information. And so when you asked earlier about, like, our epistemological crisis, I think one of the challenges is that people have become certain about all of the wrong things, as opposed to putting their confidence in the person who will never lead them astray.
Man, yeah, we should good. Maybe go out on that's that good. Note. That's pretty good. And you got that Bevington quadrilateral, you know, so we got footnotes that we'll have later on explaining all four parts. What do you want to do? Do we have time for one more question, or should we wrap? Okay, yes, sir, in the pink shirt.
David, you mentioned, you know, succession and, you know, the Civil War. And my recollection is that there were some things that were done in Washington with regards to decisions that were made that dramatically affected the South, which led to that separation. And what I'm seeing with these very small majorities in Congress and trying to remake the, you know, our social fabric, if you will, or the way we do things, you know, causing a lot of anger. And I guess my question is do the people in Washington understand what's at stake, or is it just that they want to win?
Yes.
Okay, what's time for one more question?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they understand completely what's going on, and they just want to win. So this is the thing I referenced in the talk yesterday, this sort of rise of what you might want to call negative utopianism. So it's distinct from a positive utopianism, which is dangerous in and of itself, that I've got this great and glorious shining vision that I don't care how many people I steamroll to get there. The negative utopianism is the steamrolling is the point. That is what I am here to do. I am here to steamroll. And how do they know and understand what they're doing? Absolutely. This is why you're seeing at a lot of the grassroots levels actual talk about secession. You're talking about, you know, as a Republican congressman said to Politico last week, every time I go home, someone talks about civil war. Okay? So then the next question is, well, what are you doing to forestall that? Well, the answer is, for a lot of these guys, absolutely nothing. Why absolutely nothing? Because they think they're going to be primaried by somebody who will be a tougher fighter. I've had countless conversations with people who say, look, I was talking to a lawyer for the senior counsel for a Republican governor in a red state, and he said, this is what's happening in my legislature. He said, my legislature is going crazy. When I confront an individual legislator I've known for years, they say, if I don't do this, I'm going to be primaried by somebody like Marjorie Taylor Greene. And then my friend says, but if you're acting like her, what's the difference? You know, what's the difference? So there is an enormous pressure from this very toxic, committed grassroots that politicians are catering to. Because in hyper-gerrymandered, hyper-big-sworded America, their greatest threat to their political career comes from the hyper-polarized wings of American society. And this is on the left as well. This is not something that's just a phenomenon on the right. So they know absolutely, and their answer to the division is, I will crush my enemies. But the two sides are too big and too geographically distinct and too secure in their strongholds to be crushed. And so unless we learn to rediscover pluralism, unless we learn to rediscover an idea that Tennessee can be Tennessee and California can be California, we're going to be fighting the Battle of Verdun in American politics for a very long time.
You know, I'll also say any successful politician is so because they are very good at reading the currents in their district. Otherwise, they aren't reelected. And a lot of the pressure really is coming from the grassroots, who is are basing their support, you know, as you were saying, the stakes, on many of the wrong measures. And there tends to be like, how much are they fighting for us? And the fight is measured almost entirely in rather empty, performative displays of belligerence, as opposed to the hard, completely unsexy, and often uncovered work of actual legislation, governance, and negotiation. And as long as we, the people, continue to reward those performative displays of belligerence, we will have leaders who are happy to do that.